Welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Max Kaiser. We have a great show for you today. With us we have Leonard Barkin, who is the class of 1943 University Professor at Princeton, where he teaches in the Department of Comparative Literature. He's here to talk about his new book, Berlin for Jews, a 21st Century Companion, published in 2016 by the University of Chicago Press. Leonard, thanks very much for joining us on New Books in Jewish Studies.
It's my great pleasure, Max. Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. So first off, this is a very interesting book. I'm not sure I've read anything else quite like it. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book?
Certainly. My first extended time in Berlin was as a fellow of the American Academy in Berlin back in 2009-10. And I came to Berlin, I had come to Berlin previously and fallen almost instantly in love with the city. As I spent more time there, I began to realize that one of the things that led to this passionate and sudden love affair was that the place felt profoundly Jewish. I don't know, I didn't know at first what that meant to me, but I knew I felt it in my bones. And I've since ascertained that lots of other people, secular Jews like myself, often from the States, have had the same impression, maybe from different sources. So I began to think about how that could be, the obvious ironies of saying that. And those ironies started to be themselves very attractive. I loved the fact that this was all built on a kind of absurd contradiction, but nevertheless it was there. And I suppose the real moment was that early on in that year at the American Academy, which I should say is located on the Wannsee, just to give you another frisson about this subject, since the Wannsee Conference Center, which is directly across the lake from the American Academy, was the place where the Final Solution was essentially completed as a project. And in fact, the American Academy is in a grand house that belonged to a wealthy Jewish family in sight of the Wannsee Conference Center. So those ironies pile up anyway. But early in that first time, I went with my partner, who's a photographer, to the Schönhauser Allee Jewish Cemetery, which is not often visited. It's not the very oldest cemetery, which people go to in Mitte, nor is it the very largest cemetery, Weissensee. But this, the Schönhauser Allee Cemetery, was a kind of magical oasis of calm in the middle of the city. And it's remarkably undisturbed. Everyone always asks me when I talk about it, how come it's undisturbed? And we really don't know exactly. There are some signs of bombing and so on, but very little sense that it was ever desecrated. And it's a beautiful space, but it also was a space where just by reading the tombstones and walking, it's about 12 acres of ground. In other words, not tiny, but not enormously large. Just by reading the tombstones and treating them as kind of note cards of data, you could get a sense of what it meant to have a real Jewish presence in Berlin. This is a cemetery that was inaugurated in 1827 and kept being used, eventually sort of shutting down mostly by the beginning of the 20th century or even a little earlier. But so you see 19th century Berlin Jewry there. And it was an extraordinary collection of people. So that was the beginning of saying this was a real civilization and it had a real life as well as a death. So that's where the book began.
Great. So, yeah, your book looks centrally at two places and three people to illustrate Berlin's Jewish history and legacy. And as you said, you start with the cemetery, the Jewish cemetery. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that and why you chose that to start your book?
Certainly. Partly, I chose it to start the book because it was the beginning of my own discovery of Berlin. But it also was I wanted quite deliberately to give readers a set. First of all, the book is partly touristical. That is to say, I call it a companion because though it's not a guidebook, it's the kind of book that one might take, read on, on the way to Berlin or carry with one. So I wanted these places to be real places where I would explain to the reader what it was like to be there and what you couldn't see and why you might want to go. The purpose, the sort of literary purpose of starting with Schönhauser-Allee, besides my own, coup de foudre with it, my falling in love, is that it was a perfect occasion to give a kind of census of who Berlin Jews were. And so I walk the reader through the cemetery and just quickly get a sense. And I had to do a lot of research. These are by no means famous people, or a very, very small number are famous people, like the great composer Giacomo Meyerbeer is buried there. Max Liebermann is buried there. Gelson Bleichwürder is buried there. But outside of a certain kind of expert group, even those three might not be well known. And that was fine by me. I wanted to look and see who is this guy. And I learned that he was was one of the first people to do kidney surgery. who is this woman? Well, she had was an early feminist who translated J.S. Mill's essay on women into German and so on. So I moved very quickly, for some readers, I think too quickly, through, I don't know what the number is, 30 or 40 people in a kind of daisy chain of associations. So we could say, this is Berlin Jewry. They're not all rabbis. They're not all plutocrats. They're not all famous people. But they were all richly inserted into the life of the city. So that's, and I try to allow the reader to get that feeling. But I also, because in a sense, for me personally, I'm in a department of comparative literature, but I have done a lot of my work as art history. I'm very interested in monuments, and I wrote a big book about the ruins of Rome, the loss of ancient sculpture in Rome. So for me, the cemetery is actually most passionately exciting because of the way it looks and the kinds of monuments that are there. What combination of different styles and different levels of humility or pretension they have. So this is the walkthrough of that in that opening, first of these two place chapters. The walkthrough is who are these people and how do they want to represent themselves monumentally or unmonumentally in the city.
That's great. So in the second chapter, you take us to the Bavarian Quarter, which, as you say, there was an integrated housing project, though it was known as a very Jewish area. Tell us about this place.
Well, I chose these places because I loved them, but it also occurred to me as I stepped back from that choice that I was choosing one location that was fundamentally from the 19th century. That's the Schönhauser-Allee Cemetery. Mm. And the other fundamentally from the 20th century, which is the Bavarian Quarter that was inaugurated in 1900. And that one place was in the east of the city, that is the cemetery, and the other in the west, the Bavarian Quarter. And I should say that East and West Berlin was always a significant distinction well before the division of the city. And that, of course, I also was choosing one place where people lived and the other place where they were laid to rest. So there's a kind of grand, if perhaps originally accidental, there's a kind of grand symmetry to these two places. The Bavarian Quarter was understood, as I say, inaugurated around 1900, understood it was a new neighborhood. In what had been roughly a kind of suburban area in Schöneberg. So we're in the central west part of the city and on the southern side of that, just to locate it. And it was It came to be understood. It was called the Jewish Switzerland because it was understood as a Jewish neighborhood. The truth of the matter is that possibly as many as 10 or 12% of the inhabitants were Jewish. But of course, that made it a something like double the proportion in the rest of Berlin, and of course, a vastly higher proportion than in Germany, where the Jewish population was less than 1%. So it came to be known that way in any event, and as a kind of intellectual and artist neighborhood. But it was also, perhaps its most Jewish quality is that it was invented by a Jewish landowner called Georg Haberland, who was what we would call a developer. And in this moment when Berlin was vastly expanding its population and the city itself was gobbling up more suburban areas, he invented neighborhoods. The Rheingau Viertel, as it's called, the Rheingau Quarter, the Wagner Viertel, which is a wonderful, very handsome neighborhood. Both of these are much smaller than the Bavarian Quarter. But the Wagner Viertel, which has streets named for Tristan and Isolde and so on. But his magnum opus was the Bavarian Quarter, where he and the people he worked with designed quasi-Bavarian style small apartment blocks, very, very handsome, and with a couple of central beautiful public spaces, the most beautiful of which is called Victoria Luisa Platz and is still, for my money, the loveliest public space in Berlin. So we have these remarkable picturesque apartment buildings, typically about four stories high, often with mansard roofs or elaborate sort of what, you know, in the world of Jewish things you call tchotchkes all over the place by way of design. And the neighborhood is reasonably well preserved. I may look at all of things in Berlin with, you know, with stars in my eyes. So I think it's more than half original. Technically, that's probably not quite the case. But you can walk around in beautiful streets and just looking at these amazing and witty and diverse and even sort of cranky and freaky architecture, you know, for a whole afternoon. In addition to, so that we have, again, as in the cemetery, we have the kind of pictorial element that fascinates me as an art historian. But, of course, we also have the people. And once again, I make this, I take this walk through the Bayerisches Viertel, through the Bavarian Quarter, as a walk among the Jews of Berlin. And again, many of them really, you know, there are poets and philosophers and psychologists, a gold medal Olympic athlete, Lili Henoch. But there is also Albert Einstein, and we have to remember that he lived the longest single residence of his life until he came to my current hometown of Princeton, New Jersey. The longest residence of his life was, in fact, in Haberlandstraße, the street named for the inventor of the neighborhood in the Bavarian Quarter. So the book takes us through both the kind of biographical Bavarian Quarter and the art historical or the monumental Bavarian Quarter. And I hope readers will really walk these streets because they are simply beautiful and they remain with this sense that this is what it meant to be a Jew in Berlin in the first 30 years of the 20th century. That is to say, to live among artists and poets and intellectuals and physicians and scientists and the rest. I should add also that, although quite briefly, Billy Wilder lived there as a very young man. And there are plaques for, of course, both Einstein and Wilder, and as well as many others of these people. But my treatment of the population of the Bavarian Quarter is equal opportunity. I talk about Gottfried Benn, the wonderful and terrifying 20th century poet who was not a Jew. It's really as much about this neighborhood and the kind of people who lived there, many of whom were Jewish, as it is about some kind of ghettoized Jewish person.
Great. So in the next section of your book, you move on to look at people, and you start with Rachel Varnhagen, who was a writer and a famous salon hostess. Tell us a bit about her.
Well, I fell in love with her, and I am astonished. I remain astonished that she hasn't been more thoroughly discovered, even really in Germany, in a time when people are so interested in the history of women and women's writing. She would seem to be ripe for big discovery that hasn't happened, although Hannah Arendt wrote a biography of her very early in her life. It's a strange biography, and I learned a lot from it, but also learned to keep my distance from it. Varnhagen was born in the 1770s, died in the 1830s, was a Jewish woman, Berliner, not from an extraordinarily wealthy family, not a great beauty, and she began to collect around her all the kind of bold-faced names of culture, everything from the certain members of the royal family to poets, scientists, generals, and a lot of very famous people like Goethe and Beethoven. And she knew everyone. They didn't all climb up the stairs to her salon, but a great many did. Kleist became her friend late in his life. And in fact, it's a letter of hers in which we first hear of his suicide. Grillparzer, a kind of wacky American religious nut from upstate New York. Generals whom she adored. And there was a kind of milieu around her of liveliness, of debate, of romance, poetry, arguments about Rossini and musical life, a lot of theater people. And we have a few documents. Rachel herself wrote thousands and thousands of letters, which are collected. I think that its tally is something like 6,000 letters. So there is this vast body of her own writing, but it's all letters. And I think that is a way of reminding ourselves that her genius was as a friend, as an acquaintance, and that the ideal around this whole world of Rachel was what's called in German Geselligkeit, companionability. And these, there are a small number of documents of people who have been to the salon and talk about it, or who are remembering many times in the salon. And these are, again, barely available, only in 19th century collection of documents collected by her husband. She married late in life to a younger man who then, as a lot of the friends are sardonically noted, sort of made a career of being her husband. Carl August von Ense is his name, Varnhagen, and that's where she has the name Varnhagen. Her own name was variously Levine Robert, and so she has a lot of names. And that's why I just call her Rachel. These documents, essentially, I entered the world of Rachel by closely reading these remarkable documents about what it was like to spend an evening with Rachel. And I hope I convey a little bit of that glittering world. And as I say, the amazing thing, the thing that, again, forms part of the sort of ideology of the book about the rootedness of Jews and Jewish culture in Berlin is the fact that all of these people, very famous, very not Jewish, that they, dozens and dozens of them, climbed many flights of stairs on Wednesday evenings to sip tea in a Jewess's house. And we're talking about 1795, 1810, and that although everyone always knew that she was a Jew, that didn't affect them very much. And as I point out, in this 150 pages or so of documents that I worked through, with every possible nuance about Rachel elucidated because she was an utter phenomenon. Never once does anyone mention that she's a Jew. And she certainly was, because she writes about it, not in an enthusiastic manner most of the time. So there's a kind of agreed upon sense that this was a, what can we say, a kind of special, a special zone of culture and companionability where issues about Semitism and anti-Semitism somehow didn't apply. So that's my Rachel. And I think, well, I mean, two of the three people I write about are not especially well known. And they are both, the third one is quite well known, but, and they are in their own right worth rediscovering, certainly for an English speaking audience, and in some ways, even for a German speaking audience.
Hmm. That's great. So, yeah, moving on to your second profile of, is someone that I hadn't heard of before, is James Simon, who was an arts patron. Tell us about him.
James Simon, and one has to begin by saying it's not clear why he has an English given name. That really is his name. Mm. And I don't, nobody seems to have a very clear understanding. It's possible, there certainly were family connections because they were in the cotton trade. There were family connections to England and to parts of the British colonies. That may explain it, but I don't know the reason. In fact, his name was James Henri Simon, or Simon, as you'd say in German. So the name itself is sort of often I have to begin by explaining. James Simon was a very wealthy cotton baron, and coming from a family in the classic vein that within three generations or so had moved from essentially shtetl Jewish life to very prominent Berlin commercial aristocracy. He certainly wasn't the richest man in Berlin or even the richest Jew in Berlin, but he was very wealthy. And he was a brilliant businessman in keeping the family business very lucrative up to a certain point. At the tail end of this story, both the First World War and the German inflation of the early 20s really did the business in. But the story, and James Simon is born in the 1850s, as I recall. So the bulk of his life he died in 1932. Which, as I always say with a sardonic smile, is a good year for a Jew in Berlin to die. And so most of his life, he was a wealthy and successful man. He was an enormously generous philanthropist of all kinds, to Jewish causes, to non-Jewish causes. And in particular, and I make much of this because it has some kind of fugitive relation to my own heritage, He funded the transit across Germany of Jews from the East who were emigrating to North America. And my mother and grandmother, my mother is a small child, and my grandmother did go through Germany around 1907, to through Berlin, in fact. I don't know if James Simon paid for them, but I'd love to think that he did. Mm. But besides all this, he was a passionate art collector. From the start, he was not only a passionate art collector, but someone who was clearly interested in donating art to what were just beginning to be the museums of Berlin. And from there, his own collection sort of began with rather pretty things like Dutch still lifes and went on to major figures like Mantegna, Bronzino, and also in particular, less famous names, but magnificent work. He loved painted wooden sculpture, typically from France, Low Countries, Germany, late medieval, early Renaissance materials. The other thing is that from quite early on, he started to be an extremely generous backer of archaeological expeditions in the Near East. This is a moment when England and France are vying, in, as they are in other ways, but especially in cultural ways, they are vying with each other to rediscover and dig up the glorious architecture and other kinds of remains everywhere from the Holy Land through especially Egypt. And Germany was very behind in this. And Simon, we're speaking English, we'll call him Simon. Simon was the bankroller of an enormous range of major excavations, the most famous of which were in Tel El Amarna in the Valley of the Kings in Egypt. And it's there that he, through his help and his not merely financial help, but constant direct involvement, that the really the among many other famous objects, the great Nefertiti head was found. Mm. And from the start, he was working very closely with the archaeologists and the managers of archaeological expeditions. He never went there himself, which is interesting. And it's clear that this has something to do. It's not an entire coincidence that a Jew would be interested in the territory between Egypt and Palestine. But it's certainly not a kind of specifically Jewish activity at all, as witness the fact that certainly many of his collaborators in this were, well, mostly where they weren't Jewish, but some of them were even trying to sort of displace the Hebrews as the great sources of civilization in that originary place of civilization. And Simon had very delicate and complicated relations with some of these people, but he bankrolled it and he cared about it. And he cared about beautiful things. In fact, when the Nefertiti head was unearthed, it became, unlike most of the objects, his personal property. But it became his personal property, which was in very, very shortly thereafter donated to Berlin, where, of course, it remains now as the centerpiece of the Neues Museum, so beautifully designed by David Chipperfield. Simon, but he is a fascinating person, and I try to bring that out. He was famously called by Chaim Weizmann a Kaiserjude, which was a sneer on being too friendly with the Kaiser, that Weizmann associated with too much allegiance to Germany and not enough allegiance to the Zionist project. In fact, Simon spent a great deal of money on Palestine undertakings, not only money, but managerial skills. But it was clear that he was interested in Jews inside and outside the Zionist project, and just as interested in getting them out of ghettos and poverty in Eastern Europe as he was in building a new Jewish settlements in Palestine. So it's his complicated presence as a rich man, an esthete, a Kaiserjude, and living in a time of great ferment, not just in Germany as far as the Jews are concerned, but in a time of the very complicated life of Zionism itself and alternatives to Zionism. And he sort of, in his wonderful way, touches all these stories. So that's what fascinates me about him. And I adored him. I mean, he was a man of tremendous humility and tremendous activity on behalf of causes that mean a lot to me, like Jewish culture on the one hand and art on the other hand, or of course they're sometimes the same hand. Mm.
That's great. So your last chapter is a discussion of Walter Benjamin. How does he figure in your portrait of Jewish Berlin? Why did you choose to end with him?
The choice of these three people was a complicated one itself. Mostly I was looking for what we always talk about these days, diversity in time, in gender, and in profession. I also wanted, I knew that at least one of them should be somebody people had heard of.
Yeah.
Because the fame of Walter Benjamin is extremely localized. That is to say, on any university campus, certainly mine, he is a household word. When I mention him, my partner's relatives, they say, who?
Right.
famous is not, he's famous up and down. But I wanted somebody that at least some of my friends would have heard of. And of course, I wanted, it seemed right in all this sort of happy talk about Jews in Germany that not to have anybody who suffered from Nazism would be really a questionable choice. So Benjamin, those are sort of part of the credentials for Benjamin in the book. But of course, he's he's a rivetingly fascinating figure. And nothing about him is more fascinating than his relation to being a Jew, but also his relation to Berlin. And that's the other reason. The reason that absolutely I would never have written this book without Benjamin is because of a book he wrote that doesn't get much attention because it's not abstruse cultural criticism, unless you look very deeply at it, which is a little book of his called The Berlin Childhood in 1900. And it is a memoir in vignettes of his childhood. He grew up, he's absolutely a Berliner, a relatively wealthy family, nothing like James Simon, but wealthy-ish. And more particularly, and this is true of all my three Jews, very unassimilated, very assimilated, sorry. And there are lengthy accounts in this little book of the Christmas celebrations in their house, of Easter, of all these matters. In fact, as I point out, there's scarcely a mention of the word Jew in the whole book, although the one mention is a very telling one, and I end with that. And it's a story about his being sent to go to Rosh Hashanah services and not losing his way and not getting there, and walking the streets, getting his first idea, he's probably about 13 at this point, noticing that there are women selling themselves on the street. So he goes from not being at Rosh Hashanah service to much even more secular activities. He doesn't seem to have actually patronized one of these women at age 13, but he certainly talks about it. So Benjamin has this. He had already, as it were, written my chapter for me, because it is a purpose of these, all five of these chapters, to be not only historical, but also itineraries in some sense for Berlin. So Benjamin has already done that work for me, and I weave together his life, what it means to him to be a Jew, with a sense of the places that he marks by his childhood experiences there. And so we can do a sort of, walking in Benjamin's footsteps through the Berlin of 1900, as well as floating in and out of what it meant to him to think about culture, urban culture. After all, he's the great flaneur, the great chronicler of Paris urban culture and walking, but before he ever walked in Paris, he walked in his hometown of Berlin. So we see that, and we also see the complicated way that in which he was a Jew.
That's great. Thank you very much, Leonard, for talking to us about your book, Berlin for Jews. It's a really interesting book, and I will definitely be taking it with me next time I go to Berlin.
Well, I hope to see you there.
But just before I let you go, would you have to tell us a bit about what you're working on next?
Certainly. May I, before I say that, refer to a very important thread in the book that doesn't get contained in talking about the five chapters, and that thread is me.
Yep.
It is also a memoir and what it means to me to be a Jew. And the book begins on purpose, shockingly, with a story about how for a certain number of years in my youth, I pretended I wasn't a Jew. And so we learn a lot about Leonard Barkin in the book. Again, for some readers, that's the best part. Perhaps for more readers, that's the worst part. I mean, the reader for whom it's the best part is obviously me. So it is a somewhat more personal book than merely reviewing the five chapters would convey. And at the beginning and at the end, it's really we know who the author is. But I'm very happy to talk about what I'm working on now. Quite a way in real life, although I've written – this is – Berlin for Jews is the second time I've written a personal book about a city. The other is a book called Seder Square, A Year of Life in Rome. But in real life, I work on Renaissance culture, both literary culture and visual culture. And I've written, I guess, six books on that subject. At the moment, having passed from the mediated world of literature to the less mediated world of the visual arts, I'm writing a book about food and drink, about eating and drinking and what their place is in the culture, especially of ancient Rome and of the European Renaissance, and how it is that inside the world of the loftier arts, poetry, painting, music, statecraft, theology, and so on, all these grand activities, when we look a little more closely, we see the great importance of actually what people ate and drank, when they did it, with whom, and under what circumstances. So the book is called Reading for the Food, because I take a lot of texts and pictures and say, what happens when we read Plato's Symposium and actually notice that it's a drinking party? Or what happens when we look at paintings of the Last Supper and say, what's for dinner at the Last Supper? And so it's a kind of, I'm looking at culture that ostensibly isn't about food and saying, well, somebody's eating and somebody's drinking and somebody's making food. What's that about? That's the project.
That sounds great. Well, thanks very much again for joining us, Leonard. You've been listening to New Books in Jewish Studies with your host, Max Kaiser. And with us today, we had Leonard Barkin, and he talked to us about his new book, Berlin for Jews, A 21st Century Companion, published in 2016 by the University of Chicago Press. Thanks for listening.